Wayfair's big sale is returning. Get ready for Way Day. For 4 days only, score up to 80% off all things home with free shipping on everything. From October 26th through 29th, score Wayfair's best deals, like up to 80% off area rugs, up to 60% off mattresses, up to 60% off bedroom furniture, and more exclusive doorbuster deals. So mark your calendar and shop Way Day starting October 26th at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The Hard Shoulder.
With the award-winning MG4. The no-compromise electric hatchback with a 450-kilometer range. Recharge your soul.
Well, joining me now to place her reads on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf is Flo McSweeney, singer, actress, presenter and absolute book lover. Isn't that right, Flo?
Yes, I am a book lover. Definitely when I was a child. When I say more so than now, like I read voraciously as a child. Now, with time constraints, I audiobook a lot and I do love audiobooks, but it's not the same as the pages of a book and old books that have been read by other people.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I don't think there's anything nicer than getting into bed with a really good book, is there? And to physically hold it in your hands.
Yeah, I know.
There's just something magic about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people might say that about a man, though.
No, a book doesn't even talk back to you.
That's true.
And you can close it over when you're done with it. Fantastic. Tell me, did you find it difficult to choose the books that you're going to put on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf?
I did. In some ways I did. But I mean, the first book that I chose, written by Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird, was because it was one of the first books that I was introduced to at quite a young age. And what I loved when I was just doing a little bit of research on Harper Lee herself was that when she was a child and reading books, they used to swap books between them, the children, because the books were so limited in the town she grew up in. And one of the collections of books she used to swap was called the Bobsey Twins. And they were like kind of, it was almost like early Enid Blyton kind of a vibe. 72 books, or no, written over 72 years, the first in 1904. And under a pseudonym, Laura Lee Hope. And they were the first books that my uncle, who owned a bookstore in Cork, sent us to Dublin. It was like getting, sort of like having a night of Netflix for kids now, getting a whole delivery of about 12 hard-backed, beautiful books.
So tell me
Bobsey Twins.
About your uncle, Liam, because he seems to have been really influential in sort of engendering this love of books as a young child. He had a bookshop himself in Cork.
He had a bookshop in Cork called the Lee Bookstore, just down from the Opera House. And I used to spend many summers staying with my cousins, the McSweeneys, in Cork. I was obviously a bit troublesome as a young girl and a young teen. So we would go and stay for a couple of weeks. And then sort of in August, we'd all come in to help with the school books. You know, in the 80s, people would be queuing up around the block to get their school books for the year. But it was one of these beautiful bookstores that was musty, dusty, and it had the stepladder on the wheels that would slide up and down, which we would play on. And he just instilled in his own children and in us just a love of books. It was always books. His house was just filled. He had beautiful custom-made bookshelves made that I know my cousin Anne has in the house now. And when I saw them in her house, I immediately thought of my Uncle Liam, just a gorgeous man.
I love that description because I think that's the way every good bookshop should be, that you go in, that it's dark, that it's musty almost, that you don't know what's on the shelves, that you're almost allowed to sit in the space and read before you purchase, should that be for 5 minutes or an hour.
Yeah, and like behind a bookshelf sitting on the floor with some book that you would have found. And but then I always remember sort of August when we'd be there, we'd all be busy doing the school books, so there was no time for reading, but I always came home with books that Uncle Liam said, this would be one that might interest you. You might like this one. And I mean, I was reading like books from seven, eight. And, I try to instill that in my children as well. And my daughter is a fairly voracious reader.
And why did you pick To Kill a Mockingbird as your standout book? Why go back to that childhood read?
Because, I mean, for me, that's a book that I think should be on every school syllabus, and it isn't. I mean, around the world, I think it should be, because because of its tale of morality, of good versus evil, told, I mean, when I first read it as a young girl, I read it through the eyes of Scout. And then when I came back to it when I was older, I just saw it as like Alabama, you know, in the deep South, and the racism that still prevails today. So I just think it's one of those books that it's just, there's a simplicity in the writing, but there's so many layers to it. And I think if every child in a school read it, you know, when we live in a world now that's just so full of wrong, I mean, racism on every level, I think this is a book that sort of deals with it so beautifully.
I do remember reading it as a child too. I remember the character of Scout, and I remember Atticus Finch. You can still recall those names so simply.
Yeah.
But my abiding memory of the book was that it was sad. I remember reading it and thinking, I don't like this sadness.
Yeah, it was.
In the world.
Yeah, it was sad. And I think when the book starts, you know, it's, you know, you see the children out playing, and I know one of the characters is based roughly on Truman Capote, who Harper Lee grew up with and then became friends with when she moved to New York. And, you know, and then it sort of descends into darkness. And also, you know, with her father defending Tom Robinson, who's accused of rape. At the end of the book, it's like he becomes accepting of the fate of, you know, this is the status quo in this town. That's where the sadness lies. And also within their friend and neighbor, or their neighbor, whom they think of as the odd guy and the oddball and the weirdo. And that it's about acceptance and accepting people for who they are. But there is a prevalent sadness that exists throughout the book. And that's the way life is, the way life was back then and probably is.
And you went back to reread it as an adult.
Yes.
Why?
But just one of those books, because I still had my copy that Uncle Liam had given me, and we were doing a clear out in our house a number of years ago, and it's really hard to part with books and CDs. You know, I mean, I was just kind of going, I don't really want to keep them. And then I thought, no, we need the space. So I was going through my bookshelves, and To Kill a Mockingbird was right at the very back. This is probably about 7 or 8 years ago I reread it. And I went, oh my God, it's my original copy. So that's why, for me, it was about nostalgia too, going back to my uncle. And I had watched the movie one Christmas with my daughter, and I'm always very wary of movies that are made about books. And I thought the movie with Gregory Peck, it was just, plus my mother had a crush on Gregory Peck. She used to say she'd smother her mother for Gregory Peck, and I'd say I'd smother you for Robert Redford.
And I would agree wholeheartedly with both of those choices. There are other honourable mentions for you as well here, two other books that you really, really enjoyed that stand out. And they have kind of an emotional thread running between the two of them, don't they?
Yeah, well, are you talking about Memoirs of a Geisha, and then I don't know whether you're talking about Poor or Barbra Streisand.
Yeah, my name is Barbara.
Well, I mean, I have an affinity to Barbra Streisand because she's a singer like me. And her book is 1,000 pages long. I audiobooked it. It was 40 hours long. So I had Barbara in my ear for 40 hours.
That's quite the commitment.
It was a big commitment. I was in a relationship with Barbra Streisand for several months.
So you kicked Robert Redford out of the bed
and brought
Barbara in.
Me and Barbara. And I like that. She likes her name to be pronounced correctly. People spell it Streisand. And she was so irked by that. I think it was on Wikipedia or Siri. She rang the boss of Apple and asked for her name to be changed and spelled correctly. So it's S-T-R-E-I, sand. And she's kind of quite, when I say tricky, she's a perfectionist. I mean, 40 hours of audio is a lot. And one of the reasons why I got into reading audiobooks, and this book in particular, is I walk a lot and I walk with my dog. So whatever was going on in my head would sometimes be coming out of my mouth, and I could be talking to myself in public. And I saw a woman looking at me strangely one day, and I thought, I'm just missing two plastic bags. Yeah. So I got, and when I'm loving a book,
you get lost in it.
I make an excuse to go out and walk, headphones on, and I walk, and I just keep walking.
She is a cultural icon, and we know a lot about Barbara, but what did you learn about her in that book that you loved?
Well, I mean, she was born in Brooklyn. Her father died when she was about 15 months old, and her mother remarried used car salesman, and they kind of basically ignored her. I think her mother was kind of jealous of her. She said in later life, her mum came to her concerts, would never even comment about how well she did, but would take the time to cut out press clippings of negative reviews and send them to her. So she had to sort of, you know, she'd kind of do it on her own. She left home at 16, went to work in New York and worked as an usher in a theatre. So she saw all the Broadway shows, and that began her fascination with musicals and musical theatre. And I think what I liked about it was, like, she made it happen herself. She was like, it was in early 1960s. The Beatles were there. Bob Dylan was there. This is where music was going. And she was still very firmly rooted back in, you know, sort of like Broadway music and the Great American Songbook, and released her first album with Columbia Records at the same time she was signed as Bob Dylan. And, you know, she was determined to kind of go her own path, always forge her own path. She was described as being difficult and a diva. And I think she probably was. There's a diva somewhere in all of us, but there isn't a male equivalent of a diva. And I think she was doing, when she was filming Hello, Dolly, she fought with the director, and Walter Matthau shouted at her one day and just said, "Will you just shut up and let the director direct?" And she said, "Would he talk to Robert Redford like that? Would he talk to Paul Newman like that?" So she had to battle that. Plus how her appearance, and I think an extraordinarily beautiful woman, you know, she didn't fit in to the...
She wasn't Hollywood beautiful.
But I always thought she was beautiful. And then she said a great moment for her was appearing on the cover of Vogue, and they actually did was a profile photograph, like honing in on her nose. And this was a big moment for her. So I think she always wanted to be considered beautiful. But she had to fight all the way. And I mean, through her movie career. And the thing about her was that singing was not her thing. In her eyes, she wanted to be an actress. And I thought, like, it's not that there are singers and then there are singers. And obviously, because that came so naturally to her, she never had a singing lesson in her life. She kind of took it for granted, but she really wanted to be an actress. And
so you must love the movie then, The Way We Were.
Oh, The Way We Were, absolutely.
Beautiful. And that scene with Robert Redford.
And I could watch that on repeat. And that very end when she just kind of pushes his hair back, I'm just like, oh my God.
That connection.
It's Mother Your Mother for him.
Oh,
in that.
Ten times over. But I know she'd do it to me too, so that's okay. Yeah. What was it then about Memoirs of a Geisha? Because it's such a different story. But again, there is kind of a common thread, because you are talking about another strong female making their way in a complicated world.
Yeah. Memoirs of a Geisha. It's funny, when I look back on it, I feel like I read it in my 20s, but it was published in 1997 and I was not my 20s in 1997. But it was, I was kind of fascinated a little bit by Japanese culture, and Arthur Golden, who wrote it, I think it was kind of extraordinary that he is an American. He studied Japanese history in Columbia University, and they say in kind of creative writing classes, write about what you know. And he did the absolute opposite. And when I first read it, I think this is a novel, but it really felt like it was a memoir. And
when you think about it, it was before, I think, we travelled the way we do in Ireland.
Yeah.
It's before we had the internet the way we do now. And we didn't know anything about Asian culture, and I don't think we knew very much about Japanese culture.
No, and that whole thing of becoming like, the main character is, I mean, her real name is Chiyo, but she becomes Sayuri. She comes from a very poor background, and she is basically sold, both herself and her sister are sold to a sort of like as slaves as such, and she ends up in a geisha house because she's beautiful. She's got hazel eyes. She's stunning. Her sister ends up a prostitute. So she has to learn the art of it. It takes several years to become a geisha. I know that the woman that he interviewed, Miniko Iwasaki.
Yeah, she wasn't happy with the book.
No, she wasn't. And then
she sued him.
She did, and there was a settlement made, because she was supposed to, her identity was supposed to be kept secret, and he did include her in the acknowledgements at the end of the book. And but it was just, for me, it was the fascination with the whole idea of what being a geisha is. It's not necessarily prostitution. They all want to have what they call a dana, who is like a mentor who will pay off their debts, who will look after them. There may be sex involved at some point, but it's all about the art of conversation, dance, tea making, and all rooted in very ancient traditional Japanese traditions, basically. And I bought the book for my daughter. She went to Japan this year, so I bought it for her for Christmas. She read it before she went, and she went to Kyoto and she went to the geisha district. And at one point there could have been maybe 2,000 geisha girls in the 1930s and 40s. There's as little as 200 now. But she saw them, and I had asked her to bring me back a kimono that I wanted. Basically, I wanted a silk dressing gown, but she brought me back the full geisha thing with a massive big sash.
And so you're just not throwing that on of an evening, are you, to warm up?
No, and apparently because of the way they would have to bind themselves so tightly, they could have liver damage, they could have all sorts of kind of like just physical damage from wearing of these traditional outfits, you know.
A lot of the women that you talk about, they do have, you know, sort of strength in their character, but there's performance there too, which brings me to you, because you are still performing, aren't you?
I am. I'm doing a show at the moment with Leslie Dowdall. We came up with the idea a year ago. Pat Egan's promoting it, called Natural Women, and it's the music of Carol King and Linda Ronstadt. And I'll give a quick plug. We're in the Lark in Balbriggan on the 7th of November. But I came back to music really and live performing when I was 50, and I'm 63 now. And these last 13 years have been like the best. When I at a time when I thought that part of my life was over, you know, who wants to hear an Alwyn singing?
Turns out the best was yet to come.
That's what it feels like, and it's been incredible. Yeah.
Well, you'll get lots of information on the Lark Balbriggan's website about that performance on the 7th of November 2025. To give the exact date, Flo McSweeney, thanks for coming in today.
Pleasure.
The Hard Shoulder.
With the award-winning MG4. The no-compromise electric hatchback with a 450-kilometer range. Recharge your soul.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.